This is Anna Mariah, and oh, are we supposed to? It's been so long since I've been on. Do we talk about what we learned this
You
week?
can. That's normally what I do.
I don't know what I've learned this week. I don't know anything after watching what we watched. I just, there you go.
Well, I'm Kevin Matthews, and I've definitely learned this week that in any major post-apocalyptic scenario, I will last maybe 5 minutes. That's it.
I'm Dave Gray.
Maybe. Sorry.
I'm Dave Gray, and I've learned that I will last longer than Kevin, but not as long as Tyler. 'Cause, you know, he'd be a little god king. You'd have war boys, spray
Oh,
painted
yeah.
faces. Everybody would be wearing Junko J, what, JNCO Junko jeans.
JNCO
Yeah,
jeans? What
whatever.
the hell? How do you even pronounce that?
I never
I
knew.
don't know.
I'm not gonna pretend. They'll be quoting Limp Bizkit lyrics. That will, like, their holy scripture will be all of the hot dog water. I see this, and that's where I'm going to die in Tyler's dungeons about
That's true.
8 months in. I know it. I see it.
I'm pretty sure he already like uses the metal spray paint on his face a lot, but I think he's usually just trying to look like Wes Borland. I think.
I don't know. I did see his mustache stencils. And this is
Oh.
Raiders of the Podcast.
Yay! You've already used the phrase mustache
I know.
stencils.
This week, I'm going camping. I'm going camping next week. So I leaned into that Cabin in the Woods horror by watching
Ooh.
Cabin in the Woods, which I'm going to admit, I don't care for it. It's not very witty. It's not very well made. It's pretty smug. I like bits of it. I like the first half with the guys in the bunker, but I hate all the kids. The whole ending is just fucking, here's some throwaway designs that, it's a reference. Ah, I kind it's everything I hate. It's unearned bullshit. So yeah, and like, why doesn't Sigourney Weaver just shoot him in the motherfucking face? Seriously, the world is ending. Shoot them in the motherfucking face and roll them over the edge. Fuck you, movie. Oh, we're so witty and smart, except you don't shoot them in the motherfucking face. No, fuck you, movie. You're still a stupid fucking movie. Anyway, I followed that up with some Evil Dead, which, as you know, is some of my favorite. Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Evil Dead the Musical, Ash versus the Evil Dead. I read some of the comics. I wept until I cried. And then they announced they were delaying the Evil Dead video game, and I cried even more. I need that so bad. Oh, where was I? Oh, and I watched the first two episodes of What If on Disney Plus, and I hated everything else Marvel's done in the last like 5, 6 years. Don't get me wrong, like, I understand why people enjoy them, but for me, they just kind of bore me, and that's okay. Or they totally fuck the characters. Like, Doctor Strange is not Doctor Strange in these movies. He's Iron Man with a cloak. Just like
Yeah,
Spider-Man isn't
yeah.
Spider-Man. He's Iron, well, no, he's just Iron Man, but little. He's
Yeah,
baby
he's
Iron
just
Man.
little, he's Iron Boy.
Yeah, I mean, I love these characters, and they kind of fuck them all. Like, and again, I get why folks loved Black Panther, and it was an awesome character that was done well. I get why folks loved Captain Marvel, and they did the character really well, and it's a shame that they're really fucking her in the second movie. But I also thought that they should have given it to Kamala Khan as the first, but whatever. That's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But What If is awesome. It's everything I want it to be. The first two episodes are a blast. I hated WandaVision because it didn't end with somebody shotgunning Wanda in the face.
I'm sensing a pattern of
I
you just
think,
want things to end with people getting shot in the
I
face.
think a lot of Marvel movies need to end with people getting shot in the face. Well, okay. Well, did you see WandaVision?
Yeah. Yeah.
Spoilers. 3, 2, 1. Too late now, motherfucker. She's torturing a whole town. She is the villain. There is no other villain. They pretend there's other villains, but Wanda is the villain. And what do they do in the end? They let her fly away. She learned nothing. Mm-hmm. She lost nothing. This is a world where everybody has sacrificed like fucking crazy because of these superpowered children destroying everything. It's like why I hated the last Avengers movie. Tony Stark is not a hero. He is the villain. So the fact where they're like, oh, Tony's dead. Boo hoo hoo, Tony. No, fuck you, Tony. Fuck you so hard. Somebody should have killed Tony in his sleep for doing all of this shit to us. Shot him in the face.
Sure. Yeah, like, they should have shot him in the face.
When he landed, I'm telling you, when he landed and he lifts up and he's like, oh, I'm a hero now. War Machine, James Rhodey, played by one of the best actors on the planet, should have shotgunned him in the fucking face.
Yeah, shoot him in the face.
But instead of shooting them in the fucking face, they're like, oh, you're a hero. They'll never know what you sacrificed for them, Wanda. You sacrificed nothing but fictional children and a fictional husband. Everybody has lost something. Everybody is damaged. You don't get to hold a town captive to play Barbie with them. You're not a hero. Shoot her in the face. Do your job, sword. But no.
I was so, like, I loved the start of that show. I thought, wow, this is promising. I really can't wait to see where it goes. And then, like, halfway through, I was like, oh. Okay.
Like, I thought the idea was fun. Paul Bettany sucked. I mean, that man has no comic talent at all. So yeah, that hurt it.
I think he coasts on his accent with the comedy.
Yeah.
Is that wrong to say? Is that racist?
No, because fuck the English.
Yeah, it's white people. Who cares?
Well, no, like, I like the cast. The cast was fine. Yeah. It was poorly written. Yeah. They coasted a bit, and then they didn't do anything fun or interesting with it, and they just justify mm-hmm. her torturing a city, and then she punishes the one person who was actually trying to help everyone, because, oh, Agatha's a bad guy just because she's in opposition to you, but you're the villain.
Yeah, they really muddied the waters on the whole hero-villain thing to a point, to a detriment.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fine with gray areas. That's okay. But they've really, it's so muddy now.
Yeah. So I hated that. And
I see that. Yeah.
Then they did Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And I'm going to be straight honest. I hate both of those actors. Their charisma sucks. Who play really boring fucking characters that were only tolerable. Because Captain America was fucking awesome. I said it. Sebastian Stan is one of the worst actors on earth right now. I don't fucking get it. I don't know who he's sucking off for his job, but I will replace him. I will do whatever you need me to do. Please. Cause he's awful. So, you know, they have no chemistry together. So I suffer through that, and then they lecture me about, like, okay, and it has neat stuff. Like, I can't remember his name, but the actor is awesome. He was on Alias as the partner. And they do all this cool stuff. And then they end it by telling me that the terrorists who are killing tons of innocent people are not terrorists. Because lesson? And they're so dumb, they don't realize that the obvious villain is the obvious villain. I mean, yeah. She all but twirled her fucking mustache in front of them.
Yeah.
So I hated that. Loki, man, I watched the first two episodes with the people in my house, and I made so much fun of it, they won't even talk about it in the room with me. So.
Loki was incredibly disappointing because we've already seen the potential for that character. And I think, Tom Hiddleston is, like, if they really let him go with that character, it would be so much fun to watch. And that's what I thought Loki was gonna be. I thought they would really let that character loose. You know, let's really see what Loki can do. Let's really see what kind of chaos and fun chaos, you know, he can make. And they, like, locked him into this, like, we're gonna put him in a suit and tie. Like, suck all of the fun out of that character. It was so dreadful. I was really, like, I watched the first episode with my parents, and we were like, okay, this could be neat. And then we got halfway through the series, and we were all just looking at each other like, so what is this about? Where is this going, and why is it so boring? And we thought, okay, well, maybe it'll improve, because it's only 6 episodes, we're already halfway through, we're not committing a ton of time to it. And then it got to like episode 4 and we're like, okay, might be all right. And then it got to episode 5 and we're like, okay. And then it got to the last episode and we're like, that's it? Like, it never improved. It just maintained this plateau of boring material. And it just felt like a real waste of not just one Loki. You know, you introduce the concept of many Lokis. How could it be so boring with so many Lokis? Too many Lokis sounds like it should be awesome fun and like, oh, we have all of this magic that they can use and they all have different magics. And none of that, almost none of that, I should say, was utilized. And when it was utilized, it was dreadfully boring. I just thought that was like the biggest waste of a lot of potential.
So then they start What If, and it is a blast because they don't care about continuity. Almost everybody comes back to do their voices. It is just so much fun. 2 episodes in, it's the best thing Marvel has done ever.
Now that one is episodic.
Yeah, it is.
Right. Like, yeah. It's so each episode is its own little self-contained unit.
One or two might overlap, but yeah, they're all individual. I mean, like, that was the whole point of What If as a cartoon, comic book, where every month they just went, well, what if this happened instead? And that's what they did. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
And the cartoon is awesome. I mean, the first one is, what if Agent Carter became Captain America? And it's amazing. Cause, the last good thing out of the MCU was the Agent Carter TV series. I stand by that, and you can bite me if you disagree. And it's great. And then what if T'Challa is Star-Lord? And you know what? Where they go with it is fantastic. It is so much fun. I didn't expect it to go where it went, and it was a blast. It was like the best heist thing I've seen in years. It was great. I had a blast with it. Go watch What If. I am hyped for the coming episodes. I didn't think I'd say that about any Disney Marvel stuff. I was so ready to be done with it all. Cause they're all so obsessed with, canon and continuity and blah, and setting up the next movie that nothing stops and goes, well, let's just have fun now. I mean, even fucking Guardians of the Galaxy is just about setting up the next movie. We've got to make the Tesseract a big thing. Okay. Great. How about you just tell the story?
Yeah, that's what I, with the television stuff that they've done, WandaVision and Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Loki, it's never been more blatant than in those 3 programs that all they exist to do is be connective tissue for the next films. But they're not adding, to me, they really don't add anything. It's just like, well, we've got this property and we know it's going to make buku bucks, so we might as well do it. And we've got these cast members optioned for these things. So it's just never been more blatant to me. Like, I know most of the movies are just set up for the next movie, for the next one or whatever, but the TV programs have been like so obvious. I thought like Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I think for me was the best of the 3, but yeah, they were pretty terrible in general.
My problem with Falcon and the Winter Soldier is twofold. First off, it got really muddled and it was so desperate to muddy the waters, but it did it so poorly. Because, I mean, you could have made them, you know, sympathetic characters out on a real mission and not just, hey, we're killing everyone we can, super soldiers. Fuck you, world. That is not a gray area. That is a black and white supervillain.
Okay? Yeah.
So they did a bad job of that. And then it was very much just 6 hours of, hey, get ready. There's going to be a black Captain America. Okay, racists? Get ready for Black Captain America. We're going to ease you into it. And I kind of wish they just went, you know what? Fuck you. Here's Sam as Captain America. Fuck you.
Yeah, just do it.
Yeah.
And that was very disappointing.
That should have been the ending shot of the last Avengers movie. Sam as Captain America. Fuck you.
Yeah.
And that's my big problem with it. Like, again, I don't like the actors. I don't think they work well together. I know I'm in the minority with that. A lot of people love them, and that's fine. But for me, you don't test the waters with that. You just do it. Just have the sack to do it, Disney. But whatever. Yeah.
I saw some good, some bad, and some stuff that will make Dave rage. So it's always a good week, although I'm not sure which is which. Well, first of all, you may rage, you may not care about it, but I did see Snake Eyes this week, and it's just bad. And I like the G.I. Joe movie, and I really like Henry Golding.
I forgot it was a thing.
Yeah, he's just seemingly not going to be destined to get a vehicle that's going to put him at that top level. Where he should be, because I really like him. And he's good in Snake Eyes. It's not as terrible as some of the reviews made it out to be, but it's just there. Like, the action's not shot well. So that's obviously not good for an action film. But some of the cast are good, because you've got Golden lead role. You've got Haruka Abe, I think that's how you pronounce her name, as a woman who's head of security at this clan unit. Aiko Uwais is in there, which I can't say his name without singing the Bell Star song in my head, but there we go. And the recast, Scarlet, so that's Samara Weaving, even though she's quite underused. So they're good, but it's mainly behind the camera where it falls down, and sort of some of the other main cast members. It's directed by Robert Schwenk, who basically did, Red and the first two, I think, the second and third of the Divergent movies. He did Insurgent and Allegiant. But he also did RIPD. So I'm pretty sure he just says 10 Hail Marys every time someone offers him a film. Because the guy really just keeps getting handed stuff when there's probably better people to deal with the material.
So he's a directing Sebastian Stan? Yeah, I get it.
No,
I see how it is.
Like Sebastian Stan, you son of a bitch. So like, I didn't hate it, but I say I like G.I. Joe. It's better than the second G.I. Joe movie, but that was weighed down by Sleepwalking Bruce Willis. And you know, Golding is good enough to gain some goodwill, but it could have been a lot better. What ended up being really good was Boss Level. I watched that dropped on Amazon Prime here in the UK. And yeah, that was a blast. I'd watched the trailer for this and thought it could be okay. But I knew it was from Joe Carnahan, and I tend to like his stuff. And Frank Grillo was in the lead. I thought, well, he could be all right. So it's a time loop film, essentially, with a sort of grizzled ex-special forces guy who finds himself in this predicament where every day there's a lot of people out to kill him. And unlike a lot of time loop films, this has the kind of the time stamps, as it were, but then they change because the point of this is he's trying to learn more to progress through the day and figure out how he's ended up there and what he's going to do. So that, that allows you to get the fun of the concept, but without, you know, too many, sequences that are repeating and repeating, without minor changes. And it's got a really good, supporting cast in it. There's, well, Mel Gibson's the sort of a main character, could be the big bad in it. You've got, Ken Jeong and, a small role for Michelle Yeoh. Naomi Watts is in there playing, Grillo's ex-wife, I believe, or ex-partner. And, you know, she's fine. It's a small role though. But yeah, it's a good mix. There's a good, vein of humor running throughout it. And it gets quite gory at times. And I had a lot of fun with it. Did you guys see Boss Level yet?
No. It's on Hulu here. I haven't had time.
This is, it's better than the trailer made out to be for me. And I did think when I saw the trailer, oh great, you know, a time loop film with some violence from Joe Carnahan. I'm all about that. But it was more fun. And it does have a bit more going for it in the third act as well, where it sort of, you know, gives it a little bit of heart. I watched Free Guy, which is, now I'm going to surprise you here. It's a comedy with Ryan Reynolds at the start of it, and he supplies quite a bit of, kind of voiceover narration, which rarely happens in a Ryan Reynolds comedy. Oh no, it happens in every Ryan Reynolds comedy. That's right. That's right. So Free Guy has that going for it. If you like Ryan Reynolds, you'll like it. If you maybe want to see him shot in the face.
Please. Yes.
That one. Then you're not.
The answer to that is going to be yes.
You're not necessarily going to have as good a time with it. A lot of people have compared this to, like Ready Player One and Tron and that, because it takes place in a video game. But I do think the sort of closer touchstones really are Wreck-It Ralph and the Lego Movie, especially the Lego Movie, with how Reynolds' character is at the start. You know, he's absolutely content in his world, even when mad things are happening around him. He loves his morning coffee, that kind of thing. But it's a good film. It's a lot of fun. Jodie Comer's really good in it. Joe Keery is a small role, and Taika Waititi enjoys playing a douchebag at maximum douchebaggery. So he's having great fun there. So yeah, it was even better than I expected it to be. And so far, from the big releases, this will be like my favorite of the year. From the big releases, and I know they've sort of been few and far between as the cinema tentatively works back to normal, I guess. And last but not least, I watched Aftermath, which was another one of those films that keeps getting pushed on Netflix. And I was like, okay then, Netflix, I will watch your fucking film that you've decided I must watch now. So I will watch it now, because I will be a slave to those algorithms. Like, it was alright. I quite enjoyed it. It was Ashley Greene and Sean Ashmore. So, they are the main couple. That's obviously not going to be a major plus for a lot of people, but they're fine in the roles. And, they buy a new house. That was the scene of a bloody and nasty, murder-suicide, and things start happening in their house. So you've got the aftermath of the murder-suicide. Ashley Greene had an affair at one point, so they're trying to you know, rescue their marriage. So you've got the aftermath of that. And then you've got, Sean Ashmore's character dealing with crime scenes as part of his job. So he's always working through aftermaths. So, I mean, they really.
Hold on, hold on.
They were really.
No, no, that title. That's. Wah, wah. Come on. No.
Don't say it.
What?
Don't.
Fine.
Don't say it.
What?
What's happening?
No, no, it's fine. Go on. Please go on.
Well,
are you sure? Do we need the bank?
No. No, we're fine.
Okay.
What's wrong with aftermaths?
Nothing.
Steve?
Nothing. Nothing's wrong with aftermaths.
Mm-hmm. The thing I would say about this one is it's pushed as a straightforward thriller, really. I think when Netflix advertises this, you get the thriller beats and the creepy music coming in. It has some enjoyably creepy moments. I would still keep it in the thriller category, but there's some really well done bits of creepiness there. So that's a plus. And in a way, I think it'll be more familiar and predictable to sort of horror movie fans, you know, round about our age and a little bit younger and older who have seen this kind of film done before in more straightforward ways. Cause at the heart of it, it's very simple, but it dresses things up, nicely enough. And there's a small role for Britt Baron, who I really, I've liked her since, she was, is it Mark Maron, his daughter in Glow? Is it Mark Maron? Is that his name? The guy who was in Glow?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was, you know, good to see her in a small role in this as well. She did well, but it's a solid little thriller, with enjoyably creepy moments that you can watch Dave and imagine an Ashmore being shot in the face.
Nobody wants the Ashmore shot in the face, not even the other Ashmore.
Really?
No.
Like, if you have that image in your mind, you've got a 2-for-1.
There's only one Ashmore. We all know it. They just pretend they're shooting it around regulations.
That's true. They shoot him like, it's like the Parent Trap. It's like Haley Mills. There's only one.
Hire a double to come in sometimes.
Yeah. Please. Yeah. Yeah.
There is no Sean Ashmore. I've seen Animorphs. I know what they can do.
I forgot what the other one's name was.
Me too. I rest my case.
Steve. It's Sean and Steve Ashmore.
See, no parent
that would, sounds right.
No parent would name their child Steve. What the fuck, man?
I don't know.
I mean, like, he'd have like a real, if he was real, his name would be like, you know, Inspector Deck or Cosmic Capers Ashmore or something. Steve.
Pilot Inspector.
Yeah.
Ashmore. Well, you know, it's not Steve, though, right?
No,
you really don't know. Yeah.
Aaron! It's Aaron!
Yes.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, that's a bit more plausible than Steve, but. Not
I don't
much.
Know. I don't know people's names.
Jesus. Can, you know, Craig posted something on Facebook recently, and I can't remember which one it is. One of the Ashmores was in a thriller, and just before things went, you know, horribly south, this was shown at the Glasgow Fright Fest, this straightforward thriller, but it's laughably bad. And it's so bad that there is a scene where that Ashmore, whichever one it is, he properly does it's the Charlie Day meme with the notice boards and all the string and stuff. And he's like, And he's making this face like getting inside the heads of the killer he's trying to find. And it's so bad, but it's so hilarious.
Is that funny?
It's very funny.
Oh, see, now you know why we don't use cameras, because I just live in a room like that.
Oh, no!
I'm putting it all together, man.
But then you're also not required to act on camera to show the face you're making while getting in the heads of the criminals.
Pretty much, I mean,
and to show the process for deep. Every moment.
It's deep. There's drool. You're not ready for it.
No, I never am. And I'm done.
Well, speaking of Charlie Day, that segues into what I've been watching this past week, other than the movies, for our episode. I really just have been catching up on all of the Always Sunny episodes, that are on Hulu. And I hit the end and I didn't realize that I hit the end, and then it stopped auto-playing, and I said, oh no, that's it? I want more. But I had watched, I think up through, I don't know, like season 8 or something like that, whenever it was back on Netflix, whatever they had up to that point, that's kind of where I stopped watching it. And then once it went to Hulu, I was like, well, I'm going to watch it all from the beginning. So I've only just now seen you know, some of the more, I guess, recent episodes. I just love that show. I love how, that whole show has, like, that cast. And I'm gonna say it, I'll include Danny DeVito in this. That whole cast is so attractive, and yet they are the ugliest characters. I don't know how they do it. They make themselves so repulsive. God, they're just so horrible. Those characters are just so absolutely horrible. But I do have to say that I really enjoyed the episode. And I was very surprised, by the episode where Matt comes out to his dad. And he does it through that, like, interpretive dance. Have you guys seen that episode yet?
No.
Yes.
I think I'm behind it where you were, funnily enough, round about probably season 8 is maybe when I finally dived into Always Sunny and went through them. I probably got up to about there, but I've lost. So I lost my place and was like, well, one day I'll need to start all over again.
Yeah, and then everything else, you know, it's like, yeah. Oh, but there's this program or movie. Yeah, no, I know. But I've just been, like, powering through, and I finally got to that episode. And it's really stunning. I mean, it's so different. You know, everything in that show is you know, they're terrible people and they get, you know, karmically punished basically for being terrible people. They never get ahead or whatever. And we're so used to that. But this moment where, you know, Mac, he doesn't know how to tell his father that he's gay. And so he does it through this interpretive dance. And you're kind of expecting it to be like everything else in that show where it's just like, oh, it's going to be goofy or, you know, painful to watch. Like they don't know that they're embarrassing themselves or something like that. But it's honest to God, one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. Like I was almost in tears watching it. Because it's so passionate and heartfelt and really well done. I think after that episode, I turned it off for the night because I'm like, well, I don't know if I want to watch anything else after that. It's just really a surprising and very stunning, episode of that show. So I hope you get a chance to get back around to it. I think that one's in like season 12 or 13. So it's kind of far off. And I mean, you know, you're familiar with the show enough that you could probably just skip and watch that episode. Other than that, I think we've been kind of just watching King of the Hill still. I think that's where I was the last time I was on the episode. We were binging King of the Hill, and we're still doing that. I think we're getting pretty close to the end of that series as well. But otherwise, I haven't really been watching a lot. I've kind of fallen off the movie watching wagon, as it were. So, watching these four movies was sort of like watching movies for the first time, or it felt very different. I think whenever we've had movies, whenever we watched movies, it's always just felt like background noise in these past 18 months, let's say. I don't know, I find myself kind of tuning out or not really paying that much attention, and I think it's because, you know, everything is going on in the world. I find it really hard to focus on stuff. So I think for that, I have to just thank you guys for asking me to come back on the show, because it's like, oh, this is what watching movies is like again. Yeah. So thanks, guys. And that's it for my watching.
Fun fact, the ballerina who dances with Mac is named Kylie Shea. She wrote a kid's book called Save Your Tears for the Stage. I read it with my niece. I was, it's fine.
Oh, the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
you didn't finish that book with your niece and then want to shoot her in the face. So, no. I mean, we can take that as a win.
Yeah.
There are a few people success. I want to shoot in their face, and 98% of them work for Marvel Disney. at least I'm consistent.
Me some weeks.
No. I mean, I occasionally might want to shoot you in the ass as you walk away smugly, but not in the face. I mean, like Ben Affleck, yes. Matt Damon, yes. Most of the Marvel characters, yes. Most politicians, maybe, yes. But not most people generally. I'm full of love for the people. This week, we watched a bunch of movies where people weren't full of love for each other. We watched gas-guzzling post-apocalyptic films, including 1982's Italian science fiction action film, 1990, The Bronx Warriors. 1984's Italian science fiction action film, 2020, Texas Gladiators.
Uh-oh, I smell a theme.
combo breaker. 1985's Australian post-apocalyptic dystopian action film, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And 1989's The Blood of Heroes, the Australian-American post-apocalyptic action film. I mean, okay, yeah, post-apocalyptic action films. Some have more gasoline than others. Mm. But they are all the sons of Mad Max. Half of them, well, two-thirds of them were, three-quarters of them were bastards. But just as dearly loved. Anna, you want to pick a movie and tell us about it?
Yeah, I think, let's, get this one out of the way. 2020 Texas Gladiators. So this one's, conveniently available on YouTube in a nice VHS rip, that includes all those wonderful, you know, when like you're watching a VHS tape and the screen gets that little wave in it. Oh, yes. It was so great. Yeah, I had tracking. A little nostalgia moment. Yeah, when it, like, you know, watching this on YouTube. And I watched it on our TV. We have a Fire Stick, so I watched it on the TV.
I reached for the remote out of habit.
And I was like, my heart fluttered. Because we haven't had a VHS player in a while, so unfortunately we can't experience that for real anymore. So God bless the person who put this out there on YouTube for people to watch. And only for that reason, because the rest of the movie is so terrible. It's really, really dire. I still had fun watching it. So the premise, I don't know. Is there really a premise? I guess so. So this movie allegedly takes place in 2020. And it looks about accurate, I think, if you watch it, for what I know of Texas, but it takes place in 2020 in Texas. And, it's basically, post-apocalyptic, which we've established. And there's, bands of these. Are they really? They're not gladiators. I don't know where that comes from. They're just motorcycle gangs, heavily, heavily inspired by the motorcycle gang from, Mad Max 2. Road Warrior. I mean, it is like a straight ripoff of that. There's even a showdown between I think an oil refinery. The movie is pretty light on details. There's a lot of fill in the blanks. But there's a showdown between this motorcycle gang and some sort of refinery or plant or something that is also commune, because people like live there with their families. Again, very fuzzy on the details here, but there is a great scene in that refinery that's like this. It eats up a lot of the movie's runtime, but it's this like really dramatic scene of a guy shutting down a valve. That if he doesn't shut it down, the whole place is gonna blow. Yet, at the same time, all of the families of the people who work there and the guys who work there and everybody involved in this place are standing what seems to be maybe only like, I don't know, 100 yards away or something, like they're within the blast radius, potential blast radius. They're just standing there watching him like, and the movie cuts back and forth between their reactions of, is he going to shut it down in time? And him like very emphatically and slowly and dramatically turning a big wheel. That might be the best part of the whole movie, at least for me, because I could hear in my head, if it were on Mystery Science Theater or like Riff Tracks or if the Mads got a hold of it, I so desperately want to try to send this movie to like Frank Conniff or something and say, please, you have to do something with this because it's so fucking terrible. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I kind of already talked about, like, it's a real big Mad Max 2 ripoff. There's a lot of moments that you can tell they took from the Mad Max movies. And, like, a grandma with a shotgun, like, we're going to put that in here, but she doesn't connect to anything. But we're just gonna have a grandma with a shotgun because that image is cool. And then, there's a Nazi guy? There's like fucking Colonel Klink shows up or something, and, his accent, kind of is inconsistent, which is weird because it's all dubbed. But it starts out as very, like, fake German and then sort of dissolves into like vaguely British or whatever. I don't know what this movie was really about other than a sort of string of sort of related scenes all stitched together. I liked that the bad guys, well, not the bad guys, but like the army for the bad guys, or the sort of, I don't know what you want to call them, foot soldiers, for the bad guys, had these really cool cardboard shields that also had big holes in them. And, we were only told that they're bulletproof. Somehow, I guess they're clear. I don't know. It was really awesome when, like, early on, one of the guys who's holding one of these shields, like, sort of sets it down into the ground, and you can see it buckle because it's so very clearly made out of, either cardboard or cheap plastic or something like that.
Cardboard and tin foil.
Yeah. Oh, a lot of it in this movie. I love when a budget, I love it when people just duct tape shit together for costuming and props. And this movie really, really does a lot of that. At one point, there's a scene with Russian roulette, and, the hero of the film, I almost had to pause the movie because I was laughing so hard. But he wins this game of Russian roulette, and he stands up and says, "I won!" And I was like, "No, no, no!"
He was so happy. He was so happy.
He was so happy, but it was like it felt so out of character, like because you know he's supposed to be kind of badass and like. That's not badass to me. When he stands up and it's literally like, I won! I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, come on, man. This is so bad. But it almost hit a point. Almost, I want to stress, it almost hit a point where it hit that sort of dreaded, so bad it's good part. I don't know if I'll ever watch it again. It desperately needs the Mystery Science Theater treatment. I mean, it's ripe for it. And despite the fact that there's like, I don't know, two or three rape scenes within the first 20 minutes, which is like the first. Yeah. I'd say like the first 20 minutes. They're shot in a way that it's pretty much all like off camera. You don't, it's more reaction than it is like actual anything happening. You could totally clean this up and edit it in such a way that people could riff the shit out of this movie. There's just so many moments that beg for it. I was really stunned. No, I wasn't. I'm sorry. I should have known to expect this. But near the end of the film, the band of heroes go off into the woods and encounter a vaguely Native American tribe. And then the film just hits like peak offensiveness at this point. It's like a bunch of Italian dudes in bad long black wigs, they just have some teepees out in the woods. Like, there's like zero research into, I don't know, they got like what they thought Native Americans were from like a children's book from 1940 or something. I mean, it's just like, it was so fucking terrible.
Dude, they had a Japanese guy running around called Red Wolf throughout the whole thing. Wearing a...
Yeah, what is that even about?
Because...
Yeah, just because it looks cool. My ultimate takeaway of this movie, because it was so... Well, except for the just random Native Americans. And then they show up at the end and save the day. Oh, spoiler, by the way. Because even though the shields are bulletproof, apparently they're not arrowproof. Surprise.
They didn't explain it. They're thermal.
Oh, right. Oh, Jesus. How did I miss that? Probably because, God, this movie is just really bad. I just don't understand with the existence of the Mad Max films. Why would anybody watch this willingly? Except for us. We're a special case. But, and I understand that ripoffs exist and it's just a cash grab. But even for a cash grab, even looking at the poster for this, I would go, I'll just watch Mad Max instead. Or Road Warrior instead. Because at least there's production values. At least there's any kind of values. So, anyways, I didn't hate the movie. I don't think it was like, I've seen worse. And to me, the worst movie going experience is when it's boring. This wasn't boring. It's just terribly made. It has, the only thing that might be exciting for people to watch is the fact that Greta is in it. She's under a different name in the film, and I'm drawing a blank on what it is, but that's about it. So that's all I got to say about that movie.
This is your pick, right, Kevin?
No.
That
oh, okay.
Was Tyler.
Oh, was it? Okay,
this
I couldn't
trashy
remember.
Enough for Tyler, yeah.
Okay. I just thought I'd check. Because I didn't know if you wanted to go next or if I should.
I don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm not going to have a lot to add. The main thing for me was the experience of watching this. As Anna said, there's a video rip on there, which is a fun, nostalgic time. But I messaged you guys pretty early on and was like, is there a missing reel? What's going on? There was some fighting and a rapiness, and then it's turned to this commune part, and then there are other people coming along. Should I be caring about anyone? Who's the main bad guy? Why are the bad guys after these people? What? Eventually, I realized I should just settle back and, in quotation marks, enjoy this. But yeah, it's pretty terrible. It doesn't do most of what it's, what I thought it was going to aim to do well. Because, again, as Anna said, if you want that kind of post-apocalyptic action, there's many more to choose from, and this will make you think of those. If you want, the sleaze or the grit and nastiness that it sort of has in some moments here and there, there are films that, do that in a more concentrated way. Instead of getting your post-apocalyptic fix, you probably watch something like House on the Edge of the Park or, House on the Edge of 101 different premises that can have the sleaze and nastiness in it. This hints at, it's really odd. I've seen other films, I'm pretty sure, by Joe D'Amato. He did some of this. It was also co-written and co-directed, I think, by George Eastman. So maybe they were just throwing stuff together and, making the most of an opportunity to get something done, get a bit of experience on it and get out there. Maybe. Because yeah. it seems very just bits mashed together with mm-hmm. with the loosest kind of thread through it to call it a narrative film. It doesn't really add up. Like, I couldn't even tell you now, who the sort of nominal lead was. I can't recall. And as, again, as Anna said, I remember seeing, Greta in here. So I was like, yay, there's a familiar face. There's someone I can latch on to for the 10 seconds we're on screen. And it doesn't matter what I don't know about this film, because I know her. And it's like, that's okay. I'll see what happens to her throughout this scene.
Yeah.
It's like it's not the kind of fun I expected this to be, which was a shame. It's that poster and that kind of, that cash and title, you're ready for goodness.
Mm-hmm. I thought, I mean, you said Texas Gladiators. There's nothing about it that really establishes it as Texas. And I understand they probably shot it, you know, somewhere in Italy, you know, out in like some field somewhere, and that's fine. But there's also like nothing that's really gladiators about it either, except for guys wearing leather strapped outfits. And then, like you brought up a really good point about there's potential for sleaze. That would have been great, but there wasn't even that. It was a lot of setup for some, what could have been a really fun, ripoff of these types of movies. That, you know, could have stood on its own even, or something that you would like, you know, that it would get a lot of word of mouth, but, it's just terrible.
I mean, we know that they only call it 2020 Texas Gladiators because they didn't want to pay for extra letters to call it 2020 Texas Roving Warriors. That's all it is. That would have been more to try and fit on the poster. That's it.
Yeah, we've only got so much room, guys, and so much budget. Can you shorten that up a bit? Go for it, Dave.
Well, they're supposed to be Texas Rangers.
Yeah, there is like a mention, like literally a one-line thing where they're like, oh, he's a ranger, or he used to be a ranger.
There's a few times where they go, we're rangers. And you go, okay.
Rangers is shorter than gladiators. So the budget, I guess that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know. One of the other titles for this is Texas 2000. Year 2020. Texas. Freedom Fighters 2020. The Rangers of Texas and Sudden Death.
Oh, that, actually, no, I'm glad that the title wasn't that, because I would have even been more let down.
Yeah, because that is a,
that's a big title.
That's a big title to live up to. That this movie does not. Okay, this is like,
I'm pretty sure Texas 2000 was like the first proper calculator I had.
So, oh yeah, cool.
That wouldn't have been good, a great title either.
Yeah,
it's just been like, I'm not buying a movie for more maths.
Yeah. Oh shit! Is this about math? Post-apocalyptic math?
This is actually like four movies. That don't really connect at all. They have like the same people in them, but there's no real connection. Cause the first 20 minutes are the five Rangers attacking people and murdering them. We don't know why. They're killing fucking everybody except one random woman who's almost raped, but the guy that does that gets sent out. Then we jump forward and one of the Rangers is now a civil engineer. And being attacked by bikers. And it doesn't connect to anything.
Yep.
Then we go to the other Rangers who are now in prison. Then we go to it's five movies that don't really connect except they use the same actors. The only person that has a name is the first Hero Ranger in the first two sequences. He's Nexus. Nobody else has a name. I had to look it up. They don't say any of their names. One gets a name when he dies finally. But they have a very Fight Club way of addressing each other. They just don't.
Right.
So I have no idea who's who, because they're all very, they all look like Italian guys. From 1978. They're all dark haired dudes of the same height, same build. I don't know the difference. One has a clip on ponytail and is, vaguely Japanese looking. So of course he plays a Native American. Cause, you know, that works, right?
Cause why not?
Yeah.
This the whole movie could have been subtitled 2020 Texas Gladiators. Why not?
Yeah. Why not? 2020 Texas Gladiators. Greta has four scenes. She's fine. She's actually, credited as Jana Rayan, which was like just her 1983-84 screen name for reasons. I mean, I'm sure there are real reasons. I just don't know what the fuck they are, and I don't care to look them up. It was actually George Eastman's first directorial feature. So he directed all the scenes with the actors and all the actual acting. So all the worst parts are George Eastman's fault.
Thanks, George Eastman.
But he didn't.
If that even is your real name.
It's not.
It isn't. I know.
I know. So he asked D'Amato to film the action scenes. And somebody decided that D'Amato was the better name for a director on this, and there you go. Yeah. Some random Italian bureaucrat went, fuck you, George Eastman. Prick. I'm not gonna lie, it has some fun scenes. I mean, they're cheap, they're terrible.
Yeah.
The assault on the factory is hilarious. Like, how many times do they knock that dude out? Like, six times.
Oh yeah, I love the part where the guy gets shot in the back. And like, you can see what's gonna happen, and nobody, like, after he gets shot, like, everybody just stands there. Yeah. Like, nobody goes to, like, I mean, I know, like, obviously he's dead, but still, most people would kind of go over and be like, oh my god! Or really? Like, you know, somebody would cradle him, but they all just kind of stand there like, oh, well,
you know, when it was about to blow up, they all stood by the door and went, do you think he'll make it out in time? Time to see chunks.
Stuck within, like, oh god, that scene. Sorry.
So, you know, that's bad. The evil Nazi guy is just called the Black One. So there's just so much terrible going on, but it's got moments that are wonderful. There's some crazy motorcycle punks who you don't see again because then they decide, no, they're not evil enough. Send in the Nazis. Send in the magic shield Nazis. There we go. The magic shield Nazis are awful.
That was just so, like, the worst when they jump out of that vehicle and they're all clutching these. Because at first, like, you don't know that the shield is supposed to be bulletproof. It just looks like a shield with a giant hole cut in it. So it's like, well, that's fucking useless. Like, as soon as they jump out of the vehicle, I started laughing and I'm like, well, what are they going to do? Like, they're holding big can openers, like big bottle openers. It was just so dumb. And then it was like, oh no, you know, they added some minor special effects when the quote unquote bullets were hitting them to make it look like they were just bouncing off. But I was really? Yeah, just make a full shield that paint it to look like metal and just keep it rolling. Like, you made it.
They needed it to be a bit more sci-fi because it kind of leans a bit more into fantasy with how people are dressed. Obviously, they just reused some Beastmaster costumes and shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one step away from like sword and sorcery.
Yeah. It's not a good movie. There is an evil redhead in it who is a giant goddess who has, like, you know, strappy nipple exposing top who I couldn't find her name, but this movie did teach me that love is a thing still through the years back through time. There's a beautiful Italian woman out there. Time to get back to working on my DeLorean. Yeah, it's a bad movie. Don't watch it. I'm going to follow up with Kevin's pick. 1990, The Bronx Warriors. Oh, Kevin. This is actually part of a trilogy.
Oh, no, there's three of them?
There's three of them. They were all filmed within 6 months of each other. The middle one was done on Mystery Science Theater under a different title. But this is the first one. And I think the second one doesn't use any of the same character, or the third one doesn't use any of the same characters. Oh, this movie. This is written by a whole bunch of Italians, but directed by Enzio G. Castorelli. Who, well, if you don't know, made a lot of terrible movies in the 70s and 80s. So many terrible movies that, I think it's fair to say I do not like him on principle. It's the story of Trash, the leader of a biker gang in the Bronx, which has been declared an autonomous zone and given to the gangs, all of whom thankfully agreed to dress like rejects from a casting call of the Warriors, because that helps. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known who was who. Trash finds a pretty little blonde in a tunnel who also happens to be the heiress to the Manhattan Corporation, the world's biggest arms manufacturer. So people are coming for the girl, and Trash is going to try to save his lady. And fails. I mean, he fails. Trash is awful. I mean, he is well-named. The dude is just not good at anything. And he dresses like, you know what he dresses like? He dresses like somebody's mother out on the town for the first time in years, who got so drunk she lost her blouse somewhere. He's got this leather vest that's open at the nipple. Like, it loops around his manbrobes to come together at the center. It looks like it's worn by some lady in Vegas. So, you know, there's that. He wears a leather collar and leather mom pants. No, they're just normal mom jeans, but still. I mean, the dude literally looks like, some 12-year-old's mom trying to go into the local biker bar to pick up her next father. Your next father.
Oh.
And it's not fun. It does have Fred Williamson in a couple scenes as Ogre. The Ogre, and Elisabetta Desi shows up as witch, and they're fun in their little bits, but they're not in it much. It's mostly Trash, played by Marco Di Gregorio, and Anne, and their gang, who are all like faceless, nameless bikers, and they're the most generic bikers. One of them dresses like a Nazi because, well, duh. The others are just, why, you know, generic biker gang. I didn't even know who was who. Like, some of them are dying, and in my notes I just have, you know, fat mustached biker 1, thin mustached biker 4, African American biker 2. It's a bad movie, which directly sets up the sequel, Escape from the Bronx. Also called Escape 2000, which is what it was on Mystery Science Theater, which I did also watch this week because it's one of the episodes streaming on Pluto for free. So, you know, go watch that, and don't watch The Bronx Warriors, 1990, The Bronx Warriors. I didn't hate it, but it's not like one that's fun enough to watch again. It doesn't really have anything that like sticks in your memory long term. Fred Williamson's fun when he shows up, and he has actually the lead in the third one where he plays a different character. But it's very much just kind of a boring movie. The action scenes are bad. People, like, the cast is bad. The action scenes are bad. And our lead is just, like, he's got nice hair, but that should not qualify you to run a biker gang. Or act. It's just not fun. And it's a shame, because I wanted it to be fun. But it has Fred Williamson for, like, there's a couple fun moments with Fred Williamson and Witch, and that's it. The rest of the movie is a slog. When they're on screen though, for the last act, it kind of sparks alive, but it's getting through that first hour, which I didn't care anymore. It is the whitest the Bronx have ever been though, so I guess that's something if that's important to you.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice.
There's like four African American guys and there's no Hispanics. There's no Asian people. Four African American guys and a lot of honkies. So if the gentrification of the Bronx is that interesting to you, yay, I guess.
Well, okay, so counterpoint. I kind of liked this one. It's okay, it's not great. I will temper this by saying it's not a great movie. But I thought it was fun. It's colorful. It at least had, I watched all of the movies in one day, just to let you guys know this. And I started with 2020 Texas Gladiators, and then I watched The Blood of Heroes because I thought I'm gonna watch them in order of what I think might be worst to best, and I screwed up the order on the middle two. But after watching 2020 Texas Gladiators, watching 1990 The Bronx Warriors, which is more of a Warriors ripoff than it is Mad Max.
I was unaware of that when I picked Anna. You're correct. I can only apologize.
Yeah, but it's fine. It's still post-apocalyptic, which is really kind of what we were going for.
Machine
I think,
heavy.
Overall.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
closer vehicle. Than when we said, hey, let's do Seven Samurai. And Tyler went, fuck you, it's Beowulf, bitch.
Yeah,
it went real left field in
there's,
that. But,
there's a motorbike with blades at one point. So.
Yeah.
It's allowed.
I liked that it was a pretty blatantly inspired by or ripping off the Warriors in terms of all of the gangs having their own really distinct look. And even the soundtrack kind of at points mimics that sort of synth soundtrack from the original Warriors. I liked this one. Dave, I don't think you even mentioned Vic Morrow as the guy who's
as Hammer. I did forget to mention Hammer. Hammer is fun.
Yeah, you didn't
even, there, like yeah, I said, it has bits. Him. It just overall, you spend too much time with trash.
Yeah, yeah. The stuff with the main gang, is, you know, it's whatever. But all of the surrounding characters are fantastic. It's so much fun to watch. Vic Morrow just really eat the scenery with like a knife and fork, and he is having fun. I feel like he's having fun with it. Fred Williamson is having fun with it. They kind of get that this isn't serious filmmaking by any stretch. So, they really raise, to me, they elevated the film. I thought it was a fun ripoff of the Warriors. I would probably watch it again. I didn't get a chance to watch the Riff Trax version, which I almost accidentally watched because when you search for this movie on, at least on our Fire Stick, the first option that came up was the Riff Trax version of this movie. And I was like, oh, here we go. And then it started playing the preview and it was obviously Kevin Murphy talking over the movie. And I'm like, wait, no. Oh shit. Like, and I had to go down to like related films to find the actual movie to watch. I liked, you know, all of the different gangs. I don't think they may have had names to them. I like whatever the Bob Fosse gang was. They were my
yes.
Yeah,
I need like that bit.
No,
yeah,
I think
they came out like snapping their fingers and like tap dancing in a line, and then like half of them move into a different line, like they had formational, like defense mechanism. It was, I was like, wow, these guys are great, and they're still a better gang than the Orphans from the original Warriors. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it. It at least, to me, I mean, there were, especially, you know, like we said, the moments with Trash and the biker gang, who is, you know, the lead here. The movie kind of slows down a bit, but I felt like it was better paced than 2020 Texas Gladiators, for, at least. I liked the early on, the scene where the biker gang finds one of their members has been killed, and they just like discover his body lying impaled by the riverside. And for no reason whatsoever, there's a dude with a snare drum and a hi-hat, and he's just playing the shit out of this like drum, this small drum set. And it creates the soundtrack for this whole scene. And it has no meaning whatsoever, but I was like, God damn, I'm so into this. Like, I'm sold right away on this moment, because it makes no sense, but it worked so well. This dude playing drums that's both like in the scene and just creating the soundtrack for it. But I liked it. I had a good time watching it. I'll have to go back. I didn't get a chance to go back and watch the Riff Tracks version, but I'll have to watch that along with the Mystery Science Theater version of the sequel. Yeah, that's it. That's
just for the record, the name of the Bob Fosse gang is the Iron Men.
Oh, okay.
They show up in the sequel also, so.
Oh, do they really?
Well, their leader does, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Anna's got another film on her list now.
Yeah, I'll watch it. I know it's going to be crap, but I don't know. Sometimes you just want to watch.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with loving crap. You know what? I was a little too harsh on it because I hated Trash so much.
Oh, he's terrible. He's not an actor. It's just like, we have to get a reasonably good looking guy in this role. And hey, you walking down the street, want to be in a movie?
But Moreau. That's out. But my comment still stands. The last act is where it really comes to life, but that's when Moreau and Williamson are given time.
Yeah.
I think for the hour and 10 minutes before that, they have one scene each.
Well, there's that like hunting scene where Vic Morrow or a Hammer, you know, he finds the biker gang's lair and like infiltrates it. And then it's like, you know, they're trying to escape him and they don't know even who this guy is. And he is like systematically sort of hunting them down and throwing smoke bombs into various rooms and stuff. Like that scene was super fun and pretty well staged for this movie. And then it's sort of just little bits and piece things with him throughout. He'll show up for, you know, maybe like 2 or 3 minutes here and there just to remind you that he's still in the movie, and is still a threat. And to sort of, I guess, keep the pace a little bit lively. But yeah, it needed more of him, more Vic Morrow, more Fred Williamson.
Oh, and before I forget, the third one is called The New Barbarians. More Fred Williamson. Two thumbs up.
Yes.
I enjoyed the sequel also. Shh.
I quite liked this. Yeah, it was, I was disappointed initially because it didn't take me long to realize that I'd picked a film that was more riffing on the Warriors and Mad Max. So I was like, damn it. But then I saw the blades come out of the bikes and I was like, oh, it'll count. That's okay. Yeah, it was good fun though. And I think, although it's still a little bit, it's still a little bit of, you know, that it's got that air of wanting to throw a little bit of everything with the violence and, oh, look, there's a sexy lady and a bit more violence and then the different gangs and the personalities and the supporting cast. I think this actually does quite a decent job of having a plot as well. Large part of that plot is the Warriors, but it's because of the young woman who's gone there, who wanted to keep away from the company that she's due to inherit. So she's there. The Vic Morrow popping up and Trashy's henchman being, somebody who's setting him up for a fall, potentially, because he wants to make sure it's all kind of life as usual for them. I like that. And then obviously Fred Williamson's character is a good other leader, who they don't really want to battle with if they can help it, because they can work together. And we have more George Eastman. This time he's on screen as yet another gang leader. I thought it came together well in that regard. Worked. I would agree that Trash is probably like the least of the main characters in terms of personality and wanting to sort of spend time with him on a journey, but it makes up for it with everyone and everything else in the mix, but not to the extent where it just goes crazy and feels unwatchable like the Texas Gladiators movie. You know, this has a structure and pretty much stays focused while the plot's weaving from the simple A to B through to the end. So I was pleasantly surprised by this. I'll probably check out the others at some point. And if possible, I might even make Dave watch them all again.
Like I said, I like the sequels more. So yeah, I'm down. Let's do it.
Yeah, they were overdue for me. Like, these are the kinds of films where I rack my brain. I'm like, did I ever, you know, watch these on VHS? And I may have seen bits and they might all blur into one another. So I'm like, right, I've actually got a lot of catching up to do sometimes with stuff like this. So, maybe. See, but, I don't mind it.
I also watched all four on the same day. I just didn't have any other time. I work and stuff. I had to slam them all in one day, but I did I like to finish strong and start strong. And just because then I have something to look forward to, but I couldn't this time because of issues. So I had to start with 2020 Gladiators and Bronx Warrior, and I think one ruined the other for me, but I'm not sure which.
Aww.
I'm probably going to have to watch them both again. I'm not happy about this realization.
I started with Bronx Warriors and then moved on to the film I'll pick next, which is your choice, Dave. Blood of Heroes, Salute of the Jugger. It is, funnily enough, a post-apocalyptic world. And the film focuses on a sport which is kind of like football, but at some point they started using a dog skull as the main item, and people have to get it to one end to put on a stick. Meanwhile, other players use chains and stuff and can just batter and maim players on the opposing team. I think that covers everything. Rutger Hauer is a pretty good older player called Sallow. Joan Chen is a young up-and-comer called Kidda. And Delroy Lindo's in there as well. But it's worth mentioning that you have Vincent D'Onofrio billed as Vincent Philip D'Onofrio as young Gar. So that was good to see. Was this, I think, his first film role? I think. Certainly his first sizable film role.
No. Dude.
Really?
Yeah, this is after Full Metal Jacket, Adventures in Babysitting, and Mystic Pizza.
Oh, God. Right, okay.
I mean, it's an early role. Was,
yeah. I mean, they're all right. It's like 87, 88, 89, but they're all, yeah. When you start with Full Metal Jacket,
so different.
You know.
Initially, he looked so different to me. I was thinking, oh, this must have been before, like, I recognize him in anything. That's my bad then. Just allow me to talk complete shit about it. Was already billed as just Vincent D'Onofrio in Full Metal Jacket, wasn't he?
I'm not sure.
I believe
like
so.
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
But I know in Full Metal Jacket, he was like bigger weight wise too. In this one, he's got, you know, he has more of an athletic build. His face looks leaner. I know what you're saying though. Like he doesn't look
when he first,
he looks younger somehow or something.
Yeah, when he first appeared, what came to my mind was which one is it? Is it Adam Baldwin that was in Firefly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they bear a bit of a resemblance.
Yeah, I was like, oh, he's looking more like Adam Baldwin. Like, this must mean a really early role. But okay. Anyway, that distracts me.
Your question real quick. He is just Vincent D'Onofrio in Full Metal Jacket.
But okay.
I guess maybe there was another one because right before that he was in a Miami Vice where he's Vincent Philip D'Onofrio. Adventures in Babysitting, he's Vincent Philip D'Onofrio. The Equalizer, he's in two episodes called that. Mystic Pizza, he's got the Philip. Signs of Life, he's got the Philip. Blood of Heroes was the last one where he uses Philip.
Wow.
So apparently there was another Vincent D'Onofrio somewhere that he had to be legally distinct.
I bet he just visited them at home and gave them the private pile face for half an hour until they're like, okay, my name is now Martin Banks.
Like Highlander, right? Is that what it is? Like there can only be one. Just systematically taking out all of the other Vincent D'Onofrio out there.
This is a good film. It has the power of Hauer. It's good to see the other cast members in there. Chen, Lindo's always a pleasure. D'Onofrio. But I have to say, first of all, again, I thought I'd seen this one before because of the other title, Salute of the Jugger. I always used to confuse this film with, Robot Jocks. Don't ask me why. I guess in my mind, I thought Salute of the Jugger was to do with juggernauts. So if you're in this sort of juggernaut robot thing, you would salute in a fight. That's my reasoning and I'm sticking by it. And so it turns out I'd never seen it. I watched it. It's a sport movie in which the rules seem a little bit, fast and loose. It's the future. I'm pretty sure they could still find an egg timer or one clock, but no, some little guy every time has to throw pebbles at a little plate gong thing just to mark the time passing, and it can go to, I think the maximum's 100 per game.
100 per, no, it's 100 per round, three rounds.
100 per round.
And you know
I mean, that's just needlessly inefficient.
No, bullshit. This means you get to survive the post-apocalypse because they're going to need your ass for something. You're a stonekeeper, man.
Yeah, my job is to throw rocks at a gong.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, rules.
I like the finale of this, but for the rest of it, I didn't dislike it. And compared to, you know, the Italian films that we watched this week, this is very polished stuff and pretty straightforward. But I never really sort of got invested with the journey of the characters or with the, you know, the sport itself. Like, it's a sci-fi movie that doesn't expand much of the vision of the world because it's small scale, it's about these characters. But then it's partly a sport movie that doesn't really, I think, do enough to bag up the sport that it's made in the middle of it. So it's a little bit of an in-between film where I sort of wanted more, maybe tangents going off into, you know, sci-fi post-apocalyptic craziness, or if there had been some way to make the sport feel like it always carried the importance that it does for the characters. You know, there were rarely enough kind of crowds around there. It didn't feel like the end was justifying the means for a lot of the matches. The end is where it does feel like that. And you get, you know, you're still getting the, like any sports movie, the big final match. And I like that there. And as I say, I like everyone involved, but no one of the two main aspects of it did enough to draw me in as much as I thought it would. So I was a little bit disappointed by it. But as I say, it's not to say it's a bad film per se, but in my mind, I was like, well, this could be great, because again, when I realized it wasn't one I'd seen, just because of my confusion of imagining some jugger saluting another jugger and them both being robots. Let it go, kid. I just thought, well, this will probably be worth it because of the cast involved and the setting, and I was underwhelmed, sadly. But, you know, I mean, you're definitely not going to be the weakest or worst this week, Dave. Don't worry.
Yeah. This movie, I actually watched it about, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago at a movie party with some friends. And so when the movie started, I was like, gosh, this seems so familiar. And I thought at first, well, maybe it's just like a fluke or it just seems like another movie that I've seen. But when it got to, the part where Rutger Hauer and his fellow team of juggers, arrive in this village, I was like, oh shit, I've seen this before. I really liked this movie the first time I saw it. And I still liked it the second time around. I liked, even though the game, which it, in the film, it's just called The Game. Like, it doesn't really have an official name. But have seen the movie before, and I know the bit, like the game in the movie, it sort of doesn't really have a clearly defined set of rules, but it gives you enough to give you an idea of the concept. There's the quick, who is like the little fast person, and their job is to take the dog skull and run it to the opponent's spike and put it on the spike, and that calls the end of the game. And then in the meantime, they're surrounded by the rest of the team, who are basically sort of playing out a mix of like rugby and American Gladiators, just, you know, like beating the shit out of each other and also trying to protect the quick so that they can deliver the dog skull to the spike. This actually became a real sport at some point. And I think like they sort of developed it as a real sport in Germany. And then it's sort of, you can find people who play Jugger. Now it's known in the real world as Jugger. You can play it for real. I'm sure it's toned down, or they play it with like LARP weapons, you know, like foam covered sticks and things like that. It's safe.
It's safer. They use LARPers. Safer. Weapons, yeah. But they still use a skull shaped ball.
Yeah, which is kind of an interesting and cool little touch. So clearly there's enough fans of this movie that they're like, we're going to make this into a real sport and actually play it. I would love to watch people play Jugger for real. I would totally, if that were something that somebody would do around here, not me because I have no skill. But if somebody around here did that, I would totally go see their matches and support the local Jugger team. The cast is just solid. It's one of those casts where nobody is trying to out-act each other. I love watching movies that are really like a true ensemble cast where they're all just working together to tell the story, despite the fact that there's so many known names and faces in this one. My biggest complaint about this movie is the sound and the visual quality is not great. So I feel like you kind of miss some things because the sound quality is not excellent. And the cinematography, especially during the scenes set at night, when, you know, it's post-match and the teams and the players are all kind of hanging out together and they're, you know, drinking and getting laid and celebrating their victory or, you know, drowning their sorrows after a loss or what have you. There's some moments there, like these nice quiet moments where characters are talking to each other and they're, you know, you get a little bit more information about them. But unfortunately they're shot so dark that you almost can't see anything on the screen. So I desperately want, and I know through my little bit of research on this one, there's a Japanese 2-disc Blu-ray of this movie. I'm almost tempted to get it to see if it improves any of that. If they've managed to kind of lighten some of those scenes up a bit, and improve the sound quality. I would love to see a really good proper restoration of this film or some kind of improvements on that, because I think it's a great film. It's sort of, for being a film about a pretty violent sport, it's a quiet kind of movie in a way. It has a sense of calm about it or something. I don't know. It's almost shot, to me, it evokes more of an Eastern style of filmmaking than a Western style, if that makes sense. It's not about explosions or big action sequences. It's more about these sort of quiet in between moments, or even the scenes with the sport being played out, the game being played out. You get a good sense of the action, but that's not necessarily the focus. Anyhow, I like the film. I also like, and this will sort of segue back into Mad Max, that Hugh Keyes Byrne is in this film. He has a brief role as Lord Vile, which is a great character name. Anyhow, he shows up near the end. He's one of the, big wigs in the big city where, you know, out in the fields, out in the countryside, Jugger, or the game, is played kind of just as a means of survival, but it's a violent sport, but people still survive it. They may, you know, be injured pretty severely, but they still survive it. When they get to the city where the real professionals play, it's like a life or death game. You either survive the game or your career, but your life is over. That's it. When they get there, for the big final, challenge of the professional team, you know, they're putting their lives on the line. It's really, I don't know, it's a great movie. I think it's one that deserves more attention. I think it needs more, more people watching it. I think it would have a bigger fan base, I think, if more people know about it. So, yeah, I like that one. I like The Blood of Heroes, and I'm hopefully it won't be another 10 to 15 years before I watch it again and forget that I've seen it and then go, oh yeah, this movie.
I also really like The Blood of Heroes. It's a David Peoples film. The Blade Runner guy, the 12 Monkeys guy. And there's like little winks of things going on in the city that they never really get to. So I'm curious if there was like a bunch cut out.
There is a longer cut of the movie, yeah, but from what I read, it's more to do with kind of the ending, which I guess, you know, would maybe that includes stuff that happens when they get to the city, which is the final act of the movie.
Yeah, I think there's a like a 10-minute denouement that got cut, but
yes.
Still, I mean, there's a lot going on in the city that they don't really get into. It's an interesting world that just we get a glimpse of, and I like it, but I'm curious what else they had, like what else were the thoughts going into it? I like that they don't, like, a good quarter of this movie, maybe even a third, is watching our heroes get sewn up.
Yeah, and there are some pretty graphic up close shots of like needles going into flesh and that stuff that kind of makes you go, ugh.
They do not. I mean, the effects.
Yeah, they don't shy away from that.
No, the effects are by Michael Westland. Ah, crap. No, Michael. I have it in a note. No, why can't I find my notes? My notes are being a real jackass today. Michael Westmore, which is a name I should have thought immediately. He basically did all the Star Trek makeup forever and ever. His daughter hosted the Sci-Fi Channel makeup show. I don't know if that's still on. I haven't had cable in a while. Face Off. He was one of the judges occasionally on that too. I mean, he's nice. Like one of the big names in makeup effects. One of the big guys. So the scars on everybody are unique and really well done. The cast is good. Delroy Lindo is great, even though they give him fuck all to do for the most part. He gets one dramatic scene and he acts the shit out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Howard's always great. Anna Katrina is really good in her bit. But again, they don't give her much to do. She is a decent actress who mostly played gimmicky parts. But when they actually let her have that one scene, it's the same scene with Lindo. She's really good. Joan Chin is okay. She's not a great actress, but she works okay in this role. Because let's be honest, as much as I love Twin Peaks, which we will be covering in February in depth, Anna's supposed to be here for that as well.
Woohoo!
She's not good in that. She's not good in most things she's in. I'm sorry, Joan. I don't mean it as an insult. You're just miscast a lot of the time. But she's pretty solid in this. She's actually really solid in The Last Emperor also, now that I'm thinking about it. So she has moments. I guess if she has the right director, she can do something good. And that's not a slight on the other directors, just some people work better with other people. That's all I mean. Anyway, because you know people take that, how can you say anything bad about David Lynch? I can say a lot of bad things about David Lynch, and I will, in February.
That sounds like a challenge.
It is. And I'm going to rise to it. Oh, just wait until you hear what I have. Anyway, I like the game. I love the cinematography. I mean, this world is well realized, and the two versions are totally different. So I like that. The mm-hmm. above dirt and the below dirt are very different. Again, Hauer mm-hmm. sells it. There's some nice little, there's a lot of little bits that are excellent. I do wish we had a bit more of the world or the story at large, but I think for what it is, it's great. Mm-hmm. It's a sport movie about a sport that doesn't exist in a world that doesn't exist, but it just treated like a normal sports movie, and that's kind of ballsy. The fact that a studio made this is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. And it looks, like you said, it looks great. I mean, it looks really professional, even though I think the budget was like shy of $1 million.
Yeah, but it, you know, it was.
But it looks
great. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a mild surprise that people's never made directed another film, as far as I know. I know he made a documentary in the 60s before he was a screenwriter, but I've never seen it. I mean, who the fuck looks up David Peoples' student short film documentary? I don't. I might be obsessive and weird, but I have my lines. That's one of them, because I doubt it's online, or I'd try.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of it's great. There are Jugger Stone apps if you really want to start training for your local team.
I'm good. I might do okay as a quick, maybe.
Maybe.
I'm pretty small.
Yeah, you're spry.
I can be fast in short bursts. So, yeah, maybe. I do have to say, I know I complained a lot about the cinematography in terms of the scenes that are shot at night, but everything else, all of the daytime scenes are just, they're really beautiful to look at, really well shot. You get a good sense of the landscape. Whereas, you know, with like with Texas Gladiators, it's just sort of, it could be anywhere. But this one, you get a really good idea of, this is a bombed out surface world. And what's below the surface is, it doesn't look that great either, but you could tell the people with the money have done the best, you know, with what they can. And it gives that like really clear distinction.
Well, they set up that Jugger's pretty much it for everybody. Now, granted, they could do a bit more showing the reverence for the game in the small towns, but mm-hmm. they said it's the only way to get ahead. If you're not born into privilege in the nine cities, Jugger's it.
So, yeah, you're either farming what little land you can farm, or you're a traveling Jugger.
Yeah, I mean, it's got so many interesting bits in it that, like, even I think today would land even better if someone were to revisit this and tweak it a bit or expand it on TV. Netflix, who's always mm-hmm. looking for content, wink, wink, I'm not, you know, I'm just saying.
Yeah. I think if they got a good crew and the same kind of cast where nobody is trying to be the star of the show, this would make a really good,
There's a lot going on. You could touch on, I mean, there's a lot of things to talk about in professional sports and even college sports that you could look at through this movie. I mean, this is where science fiction really excels, and not just science fiction, but other genres too. Mystery, horror, they allow you to look at things and discuss them without being quite so on the nose that a drama would make you do. And I'm just saying that there's things that could use this analysis in this setup that would really work. But, you know, whatever. They don't pay me the big bucks for a reason, because I'm better than them and they're jealous. All right. Well, let's finish with the film that is the whole reason we went with this route. We let Anna pick a film and a topic, and she wanted to do a Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, 1985 Australian post-apocalyptic dystopian action film. It is the third in the Mad Max sequel, starring Mel Gibson as Max and with Tina Turner as Anti-Entity. Max Rockatansky, who I don't think they call him Max at all in this one. He at least introduces himself in the others. Yeah, in this one, he's called the man with no name a couple times.
Yeah, and also the Raggedy Man and Captain Walker, by mistake. he doesn't really have a name in this one.
Anyway, Max is crossing the desert in a camel-driven wagon when he's attacked and loses it all. He hunts down the guy that attacked him to Barter Town, run by the ruthless Anti-Entity, who offers him a deal in exchange for the life of Master Blaster, who holds an uneasy truce with Anti for the control of Barter Town and its power grid. Then there's a bunch of kids, and it's very 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And, okay, I love Mad Max. I love Mad Max in all its incarnations. Do you know what's great, Mad Max? The PS4 video game is a blast. It is Mad Max amazingly. I love Mad Max. I love Road Warrior. I fucking adore Fury Road. I will be the first in line to see the Furiosa prequel, which I don't really understand why they're making that, but whatever, since Fury Road was her whole coming to identity on her own, but okay, we can have a prequel with her following Thor through the desert, whatever, I'll watch it. Fuck yeah, I'll watch it. I'll watch the next Mad Max when they get to it and George Miller's 99. I mean,
I'm gonna be so sad when he can't make these movies anymore.
I like the approach to Mad Max. I like that Max is a mythical figure who keeps bringing civilization to the wasteland in his wake without ever getting a chance to stop and enjoy it. Max is always on to the next place, but everything he does sets up someone else for something better. I like the approach, and I like Beyond Thunderdome. It is the most Hollywood. It's the most Hollywood of them all. And this is, you know, even bearing in mind that, Fury Road was a huge production, but it is pure George Miller. It's exactly what he wants to make without any compromise or anything. And Beyond the Thunderdome is all compromise. It's the least violent. It's the least graphic. It's the least adult. Max gets saddled with a whole slew of fucking Spielbergian kid sidekicks. There's a pop song. Everybody gets a kid sidekick. Except for Anti-Entity, who's the villain.
Right.
I mean, even the evil jerk that steals his car and the plane guy has a child sidekick. Even Blaster has a child likes. I mean, there's a lot of Hollywood shit from 1985 in this movie. But Gibson is great as Max. Sure, mm-hmm. He would eventually show himself to be a total dickhead, but when he plays Mad Max, he is Max Rockatansky, and I love Max. I love Max a lot. When it's the action, when it's vehicular action, there is nobody that does it better than George Miller. And, you know, I mean, yeah, it feels like there's similarities between all the sequels after the first Mad Max, to the point that they might all be the same story told by different subsects that broke off of a main group, because that, damn it, they are all the same story. They're all the same. And I still love them, but you know, in yeah. one Furiosa, it's the feral child. What's her name? I can't remember her name. And then it's Furiosa, but they're all the same character. Mm-hmm. And they're all on a big rig being chased by others. They're all the same movie. I love them though. They're all telling the same story in slightly different ways. And when it happens a fifth time, I will be there happy as shit.
Yeah.
Taking in whatever Miller wants to show me.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is the least of the bunch. And that's not a bad thing. If this wasn't a Mad Max film, I think it would be much better loved than it is. Tina Turner is great as Anti-Entity. She is cacklingly insane. I will admit, I think Master Blaster's a bit too goofy, gimmicky. I mean, like, just let him fucking speak English normally. Most people do. Why the fuck do you have him talking like Yoda? Oh, right, because it's 1985. Fuck you, Hollywood.
Thanks, George Lucas.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little insulting. Like, oh, he's a brilliant electrician and technician, but we won't let him talk like a normal person. He's going to say, me, leader. Me, in yeah. charge. He's like, oh, fuck yeah. you.
Oh, master fuck you. Run Barter Town. Yeah, he skips a lot of Town.
Yeah, he's just...
Yeah.
He's a bit much. I mean, you know.
It's a shame because I love Angelo Rossetti.
Me too.
So much. I love seeing him in all of the things. I get so happy when he shows up in a movie. So, yeah, I love him here, and it does feel like a little bit of a waste. Like,
I agree. And I love that they put him in a tweed suit when he gets out of Barter Town.
Like, oh, yeah, I love his outfit. He's got, like, his spectacles and his hat and his little... I mean, he's all, like, yeah.
I mean, there's like a lot of things. There's a lot of things I love. I love that there's 22 and a half minutes before the word Thunderdome is ever spoken. And then after that scene, it's never spoken again.
Yeah.
They get because beyond that Thunderdome.
Thunderdome.
I love the Thunderdome sequence. That is one of the most fun action scenes from that decade. I mean, let's put them on rubber bands and bounce them around a death cage. Yes.
And if you can catch the weapon, you can use it. Like if you can snatch it from the upper realm of the Thunderdome.
There is so much I enjoy in this movie. I just wish that it had a better... I mean, even if they kept the kids and stuff, if it was just a little bit less Hollywood, a little bit less, oh, we've got to make it so it can be edited for TV broadcast. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit more, like they don't even kill anybody except for Blaster and one kid in the quicksand. Like even Iron Bar, who Max kills like four times in the movie. Doesn't die. It's just one of those things where I get what they're trying to do, and I understand diminishing returns and having to work in the studio system and for someone else, but if this wasn't a Mad Max movie, I'd probably like it so much more than I do. As it is, I still enjoy it. I have a blast with it, but it's not on par with the rest. And that's, if I compare it to the rest of the movies this week, the only one even close to it is Blood of the Jugger or Blood of the Heroes. But compared to the rest of the series it's the goofy little brother that you just kind of pat on the head and go, okay. But it gave us the California Love music video, so I guess that makes it a little bit better than the original, but only a little.
I can't really disagree with anything you say, Dave. I also love all Mad Maxes, as fine and varied as they are. I enjoy this. Every time I end up watching Beyond Thunderdome, that first half or third, I'm like, this is great. Why do I never rate this one as highly as any of the others? What's the problem? Tina Turner's really good in her role. Like, she's fantastic, suits the part, and is just great, with the look and how she carries herself in that world. The plot, works well. It's still nice and simple and straightforward. You know, someone's taken something that Max, had, and he wants it back. That's really how it starts. It's great. Yeah. And the Thunderdome sequence itself, brilliant. It's funny how the sort of the bungee cords, whatever, can be a great, help. And then also sometimes be a hindrance, depending on what tactics you want to use and where you can get to the weapons. So I'm all in. I'm like, it's great. I will be telling everyone that they're wrong for not rating the third Mad Max installment as highly as any of theirs. And then he gets dropped in with all of the kids that didn't get parts in Hook. And it's just downhill from there. But then it's a section that goes downhill. It picks up again for the end. I like the end. I like the expansion of the idea of the myth of what will carry on in a variety of stories that aren't necessarily everything that we've just seen as viewers and aren't necessarily going to be how things really happened. But it doesn't matter. The essence of how things happened. They are the stories that they will tell to inspire each other to keep going on and, you know, making progress in this world and environment. And it's great. It's a really, that idea at the end of this, is just as much a part of the Mad Max like franchise as the brilliant stunts and car chase sequences and the action that, just that exploration of stories being passed on in that kind of world as well and becoming myths and building. Because, you know, at the start of Fury Road, I think when people were wondering, is it the same Max? And, you know, what's the connection? In a way, it doesn't matter so much because the heart of it's the same. There's a character carrying on that tradition or what that idea of what needs to be done. So there is, you know, a hero. And funnily enough, as much as I'm not a big Tina Turner fan, really, from her pop hits over the years, they've really been sort of my thing. But it's also a really good song for this film. I just got to say that. Like, now, I wasn't sitting there and writing down all the lyrics and stuff and be like, yeah, really appropriate stuff. But it's just, it's a great tune and it works with the film. So like all around, Tina Turner gets top marks. But I still love Mad Mel. The rest of the cast do well. It's kind of the middle section where it falls down. But picks up again for that finale for the third act.
Here's a question before Anna chimes in. Have you guys seen the play Mr. Burns, a post-electric play?
No.
Why'd you always ask questions that
I thought you might know this one.
And I mentioned the short story, and you never once said to me, have you read the short story? And at one time, I could have said, I've read source material that you reference. But no.
I knew you'd both read that one.
I've seen this obscure play that was put on in a seventh grade class at the school.
It's not an obscure play. It was on Broadway. It was off Broadway. It started at the Woolly Mammoth here in D.C. It won a Drama League Award. I mean, this is...
I'm pretty sure you put it on in your front room after you made a cardboard fort.
I am offended. It was written by Anne Washburn, who's a Guggenheim fellow. You know, won the Herb Alpert Award in Arts Theater.
No, I'm sorry. I'm unaware of it.
Anyway, yeah. It's basically this. It's Mad Max, but The Simpsons.
So after
the apocalypse, a group gathers together, and one night, and to cheer each other, the survivors recount the episode Cape Fear of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. Great episode.
It's one of my favorites. And then the second act is years later with the same group who have formed a theatrical troupe that specializes in performing Simpsons episodes with commercials and all. And then the final act is like 100 years after that, and it's become, you know, a musical pageant. It's myth that's familiar to everyone, but not the episode. The story is told by this group, and it's just really interesting, and it connects, and I thought, hey, that'd be a fun thing to discuss, but, you know, whatever. Fucking heathens.
Sorry. oops.
I mean, it's not like I haven't now given Dave the idea to stage plays in a cardboard fort in his front room. So,
yeah, that wheel like is idle already. Turning now. Yeah.
With puppets.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, for Killa's birthday, I got her this Lego movie making. Dude, you should see. She, like, is prolific with her own short films. I've created a monster.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah.
So I love Beyond Thunderdome, and it's taken me a little bit of time to come around on it because I remember, like, I grew up watching the first three Mad Max films. They were part of my film childhood. As it were, especially the second one. That's always kind of been the house favorite, the Road Warrior. But I've grown to really love and appreciate Beyond Thunderdome for what it does. And Kevin, you really touched upon what I wanted to talk about is sort of the storytelling aspect of it and the idea or the concept of oral tradition and how important that is. And it does sort of end up making Max into this myth, this legend that, you know, I think every myth, every oral legend, started with some real thing. And over time, you know, the story kind of changes a little bit. It sort of, you know, every new person that tells a story adds their own little bits and pieces to it. And then it becomes this huge sort of thing. And I like that Beyond Thunderdome sort of sets that up. And it plays really well into Fury Road. All of the movies, despite being, in my mind, they are so different from each other. And mostly it's in terms of style. The first one is just straight up carsploitation kind of movie where it's, you know, gangs of bad guys and their cars and just chasing each other. And the first one kind of also has a dip in it, where Max and his wife and child, you know, go on vacation basically. And there's a lot of quiet moments in there, and then it ramps back up at the end. The second one definitely goes like, okay, now we're post-apocalyptic. But it starts with, you know, that explanation of what's happened since the last one. So immediately it puts you into the oral tradition of storytelling. Okay, we're gonna like narrate and show you with some brief pictures, like, here's what's happened since the last time you saw this character. And there isn't that kind of beginning in Beyond Thunderdome. It just sort of plops you into the desert. It's complete desert now. And Max has clearly been out wandering for God knows how long. I mean, his hair is super long and he's definitely a raggedy man. But what I really like about Beyond Thunderdome is this is the movie where Max is sort of set aside and they start to bring in the concept of these really strong, really nuanced, I mean, as nuanced as you're going to get in these kinds of films, women characters that sort of take the lead at some point or become more of the focus. So you have Anti-Entity on one side of it. And then on the other side, you have Savannah Nix. And they're sort of, in my mind, kind of two sides of a coin. You know, Anti-Entity is more like shrewd and controlling, but there's still a benevolence about her. And Savannah she's more caring and kind of motherly, but she's also fiercely protective of her clan of children. But that leads in so well. And I know, like, you know, when the movie came out, we didn't know it at the time, but I love how that really leads into Fury Road, where it's really the women running the show in that movie. Max is almost, I mean, he's really kind of a side character in Fury Road. He's just sort of a guy along for the ride. And again, doesn't even get named until the end of the movie, where he says, you know, like she's asked him at one point earlier, you know, what's your name? And he doesn't say anything. And then at the end, he says, Max, my name is Max. So you don't even know really who he is. I mean, you know who he is, but he doesn't have a name for the bulk of that film. I know Beyond Thunderdome does sort of forget the plot in the second act, or it takes this really wild swing into, you know, him finding this cargo cult of children who are waiting for their savior to come and take them to Tomorrow Morrow Land. I don't know. I find it so hard to separate these films in my mind. I mean, I can watch any of them independently of each other and enjoy them, but I think they really work well as an entire, as parts of a whole. And I love how each of the movies connect into each other, and there's little bits and pieces that show up in the film prior or in the film that you're watching that you saw in the previous ones. I love the little pieces, the little visual things, the little, bits of connective tissue amongst these films. And I think you couldn't have Fury Road if you didn't have Beyond Thunderdome prior to it. I don't think you can take it out of the equation. Again, it sets up that oral tradition so well, and the idea that Max could kind of be anyone at this point. He's not, by the time, you know, we get to Fury Road, he's anybody. He's this wanderer. I still want to know how he gets his car back from the end of, from Road Warrior to Fury Road. Anyways, doesn't matter.
He didn't. Because they're the same story. They're the same story, just told decades apart.
Yeah, no, I know. I know, you know, what you're saying. And basically, if you boil all of the films down to the very, very basic, you know, it's, car chase goes this way, car chase goes that way. And, you know, that's kind of it or whatever. But yeah, I'm like you, Dave. I love these movies. I love the character names that George Miller comes up with for these. And I love that he, at the beginning of this one, he's gives, all of these different characters, kind of equal credit at the beginning. And it's so wonderful. I mean, of course there's Max, but then, you know, you have Anti-Entity, Master and Blaster, which are, you know, basically treated as one character, Master Blaster. Savannah Nix is great. Screwloose, love that guy. And his whole look is very clearly like the inspiration for the War Boys, for the Half-Life War Boys in Fury Road. That pale, pale skin with the dark eyes. It's, I don't know. I really love this movie. I had hoped that we could do an entire Mad Max special, but I think it's, I think this worked out great, you know, to talk about some of these other movies that are very clearly inspired by the huge success of the Mad Max films. I like that, that Miller sort of has this, it's not a huge tradition, but he brings back Bruce Spence from The Road Warrior in this film, but as a totally different, no, I take that back. He's not a totally different character. He's kind of the same character as the Gyro Captain, but now he's got a kid and he's flying a plane instead of a gyrocopter. But he does that same thing with Hugh Keyes Byrne. You know, he is the antagonist. He's the leader of the gang in the first Mad Max movie, and then he brings him back again in Fury Road as Immortant Joe. So I like that he's willing to cast the same people in different roles in his films. I love that little bit. Anyways, huge fan. I think Beyond Thunderdome is such a key film in the series. I wish more people didn't just sort of write it off as the one with the kids or the one with Tina Turner. There's more to it, and it is a really good film. Just, you know, don't watch it too late at night because you will probably fall asleep somewhere in the second act. But the end does really pick up again. I love the idea of having a chase scene that involves basically a train. So there's no movement. You can't like shift this way or shift that way. You're you're only going to be on those tracks, and it still ends up feeling really inventive and super fun to watch. So yeah, love it.
I think it's interesting how the villains get more monstrous with each film.
Because, oh yeah, for sure.
I mean, Toe Cutter is straight up just a reject from a Rinfest. I can't play the king. I'm going to start a motorcycle gang.
Yeah. His name is probably the scariest thing about him.
Shakespeare at you till my men run you over.
But I love, Anti-Entity, even for being the bad guy, you do still get the sense that she has some kind of, she does care enough about Bartertown to try to keep it running. And, you know, her ass is in a sling with Master Blaster. So there is that really cool, like, sort of balance of power thing happening between those two. Of course, you know, it only ends, with her on top and her still, you know, running Bartertown. And then we get to Fury Road with Immortan Joe, and he's like, don't get addicted to water. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Well, you know, a couple generations of Half-Life Warboys in, you can do whatever you want, you know?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you basically become the Nestle Corporation.
Yeah, just one was still alive when that stuff was going on. So, you know.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you give your guys toxic nuclear cancer.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
They don't have time to learn things.
Yeah, precisely.
Like a lot of the design, it's just one of those things, right? Maybe it's because we covered all of the, I mean, this finishes out Mad Max for us on this podcast. So we just did, Road Warrior and Fury Road within the last year. And I don't normally watch them that close together. Like once every 2 years, I'll watch one of them. So I don't overload, but the visual cues are really, really noticeable. But Humongous is the design they use for Blaster, and Iron Bar is one of his lackeys, and they're both slightly changed in, you know, that's all. It's just one of those things I really, it just really drove home on this viewing where I was like, I knew it, but duh.
Yeah.
It's time to pick one.
Yeah, it is. I think, yeah, if you watch all of the movies back to back to back, you can really spot all of these little things that you'll see in the later films. It's so wonderful to watch them all as close together as possible. Like, you know, the little music box that he gives the feral kid in the second movie, the same thing. It's a different song, but there's in Fury Road, one of the girls has a little music box, those little wind up ones or the ones where you, you know, crank it.
The record in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did forget to mention one other thing that I really liked about, we kind of talked about it with Master and, you know, his odd way of speaking. I really liked the children's, the way that they spoke. In particular, when Savannah Nix is doing the tell, which is, you know, every night they tell the story so far. And that sort of like weird kind of pigeon language, pigeon English or whatever that they use, you know, that they get words kind of mixed up or not mixed up, but they're sort of quasi-English or whatever, you know, they don't say remember, they say member. And, you know, they call it tells instead of like storytelling. And I love that language that they use. I'm really fond of that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Miller crafts a hell of a world in these movies.
It's
one of those things where I was watching and I was thinking, it's such a shame that Gibson is such a fuckhead and made these delayed 20 years between. Cause they were rumbling. Yeah. I remember they were like, in the 90s, we're going to start another Mad Max. It's coming. It's coming. And then he assaulted a cop.
Yeah. And he went on this horrible
anti-Semitic rant. And they went, we're not making Mad, not with Mel Gibson. No.
Yeah, that's just box office poison at that point. It is such a shame because he really seems suited for the role. He's so great at not speaking sometimes. I mean, like, the brevity of language for that character, I think he does it so well.
He's very expressive physically.
He is. Yeah, he is. He's, oh, God, he's such an awful person. And he is such a good actor. It really makes me mad because he is a good actor. I'm sorry. But he's just a shit human being.
I just want one more with, Hardy, because Hardy's got it also. He can do the physical without the talking, but cause, you know, once Miller's gone and he's old, he's so old.
He is.
It's either gonna die or it's gonna get bastardized. And I just like to see one more, cause it's not like, I mean, I'd love to see Mad Max out of Mad Max and, Indiana Jones. I would love to see get the Bond treatment. I don't think any actor is 100% necessary for a role. There's always other people that can play it.
Yeah.
But I'd love to see them become truly the iconic characters they were made to be. Anybody can be Max. If other people can be Indy. Although they're going to kill Indy in the next movie, so that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's really like that role is so tied with Harrison Ford that I know what you're saying. I think if they find the right person, everybody would go, oh yeah, you could have this last forever. But, I was wary at first with Mad Max. Because that role is so tied in my mind to Mel Gibson. And when they said Tom Hardy, I was like, okay, like I'm intrigued enough to go see it. And then when I saw the film, I was like, oh my God, he is perfect. Like keep him in the role until, until he can't do it anymore, doesn't want to, or until God forbid he goes on his own anti-Semitic rant. I don't think he will. He seems like a fairly decent chap. But.
Well, he's English, so it's going to be anti-Pakistani or something. But still,
yeah, unfortunately,
maybe Polish.
But yeah, I was really so pleasantly surprised with him taking on that role because, like you said, he has the physicality, but he also he can tell a lot with his face and not saying anything. And I think, you know, in Fury Road, Max has so few lines in that, and it just works so well. But it is a kind of passing of the torch in a way, and Beyond Thunderdome sets that up, you know, where we're going to, you know, give other people a little bit more screen time and a little bit more focus than just this one guy and play on the strengths of those supporting actors. I love Helen Boudet as Savannah Nix. She is just fantastic. You can't take your eyes off of her when she's on the screen. She has a pretty commanding presence. And when you're up against someone like Mel Gibson, some big star, that's pretty good feat. And she really holds her own, in this film. So.
Yeah.
We lost
Kevin. He won't be back because it's 2 a.m. there.
Oh yeah, it is. Oh, did he message? Yeah.
It happens occasionally. Normally he's able to tough it out, but this time.
No, I understand.
Just didn't. We went a little hardcore.
We did. And I still have like some laundry to do and stuff. So let's, I have other shit to do as well.
It's time to pick one. It's Beyond Thunderdome, right? Kevin says it's Beyond Thunderdome.
Kevin says that it's Beyond Thunderdome. I don't know. What do you say? You say?
I say it's Beyond Thunderdome. I mean, duh.
I'm going to go with it as well. Although, The Blood of Heroes is really high up on the list for me out of this week's films. But yeah, I'm also going to go with Beyond Thunderdome. So I guess that means I got the sweep.
You did. Yay! Tyler's not here, but he'd go with it too. I don't know. He wouldn't. He'd probably go with the Bronx Warriors, but he's not here.
Yeah,
so
I think he would go with Bronx Warriors, but he's got something else going on. I hope all is well in Tyler world.
Yeah. Next week I won't be here. I don't know. We'll either have a blast from the past or something new with Tyler and Kevin. They haven't let me in on their plans. So surprise for me. Yay. But, the week after that, in 2 weeks, right before we recorded today, the news of Sonny Chiba's death broke. I adore Chiba, so we're gonna do a Chiba tribute with, Golo 13, the Japan and Iranian co-production, and Golgo 13, I can never remember the right way to say it, and, The Street Fighter. So two classic Sonny Chibas. Maybe Anna will come back and join us for those.
I would love to.
Nice.
I would absolutely love to.
As always, you can reach us on our Instagram, our Facebook page, our Twitter, our Blogspot. We are Raiders of the Podcast everywhere. If you really need to get a hold of us, you can email us at raidersofthepodcast@gmail.com. And basically anything you tell us there, we will, if you want to enforce something terrible on us, that's the way to do it. We're suckers and we're desperate. Be sure to like, subscribe, and leave a comment on your podcasting platform of choice. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us, Anna. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Absolutely. My pleasure.